Welcome to Whiskey Shenanigans. I'm your host, Randy Warren. Whiskey Shenanigans, where we help our listeners experience the world of whiskey, every aspect of life, as if it was accompanied by a glass of bourbon. The sports world on whiskey. Basically every part of life on whiskey. Whiskey Shenanigans is about getting exclusive interviews from Bourbon Row in Kentucky, where we can learn about the secrets that make our favorite bourbons unique. We will get inside the hearts and minds of many distillers and help you understand what and how they are achieving it. Whiskey Shenanigans is about going beyond boring podcasts featuring just tastings. Heck, what do you get out of that anyway? It's about bringing on guests and experiencing the entire world through whiskey. But be warned, if you're diving in and you want to participate in these riveting discussions, you will need to grab a glass or a dram and be prepared to be entertained. Hello again, Whiskey Shenanigans fans. We are very excited today to have with us Michael Bilello. Michael is the president and CEO of the American Whiskey Association. So I guess the first question, Michael, is this is relatively new, like what, about a year or so old?
Yeah, it's about 8 months. First of all, Randy, thanks for having me on today. I really appreciate it. I think you do a great job. And so hello to all your loyal listeners. The American Whiskey Association was founded in 2025, but it was really an idea, if you will, of all the founders that there was a process in place that took several years for things to kind of come to fruition. But I was recruited and retained as the first employee, really. So president and CEO as of September 20th of last year.
Nice. So the board is mostly consisting of major distillers, or who's on the board?
Yeah, so the founding members are, folks I'm sure that you've heard of. So, you know, Sazerac and Suntory Global Spirits, Brown-Forman, Campari, Pernod Ricard, Independent Stave Company. And Diageo. Those are the founding board members. Then on the board, you also have MGP, Constellation. We have CEI. We've got Discus is on that board as well. So a really good representation of not only industry producers, but when you look at the entire supply chain, Independent Stave Company as a cooperage, Discus as another trade association trade body, it's a really good group.
So I read all about kind of what your objectives are online, but why don't you tell our listeners just in brief, like why did you form this and what are you trying to accomplish?
Yeah, so really the mission is very simple and very exciting and inspirational. It is to make American whiskey the world's whiskey. And the way we're going to do that is by protecting, promoting, and leading American whiskey. And so our focus really is when you look at the state of American whiskey, if you will, right? We just came off of a historic high. And now we are in a place where things are starting to normalize, right? When you look at the numbers, when you look at the sales data, regardless of the data set, whether it's, you know, IWSR or SipSource or Nielsen, things are beginning to normalize. On a volume standpoint, things are getting back to really where they were just prior to the pandemic. But when you look at the premiumization numbers, they're actually very inspiring. I think those who are saying that premiumization is dead aren't looking at the right data set. But with the normalization of things here in the U.S., we know that we can no longer rely on the domestic market to make our goals. And when I say by goals, I mean the intention of all of this amazing American whiskey aging in rick houses across the country, not just in Kentucky, not just in Tennessee, but literally from the Atlantic to the Pacific. And so we know that we have to look at our export markets. When we look at our export markets, you know, there are the export markets that we've always been able to rely upon. UK, right? Great market for American whiskey. EU, there's some tremendous countries in the EU who have a real affinity for American whiskey. You know, German, the Germans love American whiskey. They love the ryes, the bourbons, the higher proof expressions. But then when you look at France, their palate is a little bit different, but they really do, you know, enjoy some of the expressions that are around that, you know, 100 proof, a little bit smoother on the palate. You know, when you look at Italy, right? Italy, they're, you know, big into American whiskey, into cocktails. But regardless, EU, there's a lot of potential for additional growth. The way we're going to accomplish that is through, I think, mixology programs and cocktail culture. When you look outside of the UK and EU, right? Canada, what's happening in Canada? Well, we now know that in Canada, we have all but been shut out of that market, right? There's a essential boycott of not only American whiskey, but American spirits in general, except Alberta and Saskatchewan. But then just coming out of recent meetings here in Washington, D.C., learning about some retaliation in by the form of tariffs that are going to happen. You know, President Trump has said that they could be, you know, tariffs could go on Canadian products as high as 100%. So that's not a great market for us to be relying on right now. In fact, it's a market that we would say has been lost, right? There's significant loss there, albeit they are only 1% roughly of the American whiskey market. So when you look at the markets that are established, you know, and we rely upon, just touch upon a few of them, UK, EU, Canada, Latin America, great things happening in Brazil and throughout Latin America, Australia, another really, really strong American whiskey market, although it's very hard to compete there given the taxes that are on U.S. whiskey in that marketplace. What we're really excited about, though, are those markets where we have barriers to entry. But the upside potential, if we got an actual, you know, trade deal that could level the playing field, India being the top one, right? India, biggest American whiskey or biggest whiskey market by volume in the world, aspiring middle class, right? They're going to have 1 billion people in their middle class in a few years. So there's a lot of potential there. There's a real affinity for American whiskey. And when you talk to the younger generation, the middle class Indians who are you know, aspiring to achieve stature within their country, they don't want to drink their father's scotch. They want American whiskey. So there's real potential there. I just came back from Singapore. Singapore, another great market for American whiskey. In fact, a springboard for American whiskey into the rest of Asia. When you look at the rest of Asia, you know, Vietnam, the Philippines, Thailand, these are markets that have a lot of potential. So bottom line is, I know I meandered a little bit there, but the bottom line is we can no longer just rely on domestic sales. We have to look at export markets. And we look at export markets, we can't just look at our traditional export markets. Even though there's room there to take market share and move the needle, we have to look at markets where there's a lot of potential, but the current playing field there is not level for American whiskey like India. But the upside potential there is tremendous.
Didn't India Trump put, what did he do? I thought he came to some kind of a deal with India to,
yes,
to drop tariffs or something like that on American whiskey so that it could be imported to India. Because they used to have like 100% or right, even 150% tariffs on American whiskey. What's the status of that?
Yeah, Randy, you're spot on. So the tariff from India on American whiskey was at 150. Modi came to visit Trump when he first was elected in January of last year and dropped it from 150 to 100, but just for bottled bourbon. 150 remains in place for rye, wheat, all the other classifications of whiskey. So we've been working very closely with the U.S. Trade Representative on getting a better deal for American whiskey in that marketplace. U.S. has an amazing ambassador there in Sergio Gore, who I think is really leading and representing American companies, American interests in India. And so we hope, and we're very hopeful that this new deal that we are very, very close to getting the details on and being able to speak about freely is going to put American whiskey on a level playing field with Irish and Scotch. And Irish and Scotch, as you know, in that country, they've got a pretty good deal. They have a better deal than American whiskey. We need a better deal in order to compete there and meet consumer demand.
That's fantastic. That'll be great. I mean, that is just a massive market. I mean, if you think about
huge,
they have what, 6 times more people than we do in that country than we have in ours. And yeah, it's just a huge market that would be great for us to open that up. And Latin America too. I was talking to a craft distiller down in San Antonio, Texas, and he was telling me like his number one selling product is agave infused bourbon. Like people in Mexico, that's what they like. They're like really enjoy it, and it's just flying off the shelves. Like, there you go. I mean, you've got to tailor it to, certain demographic tastes, and sure, that's okay. I mean, they make a great product, and now they add a little bit of local flavor to it, and wham, you got a real hit.
Yeah, and that's why I'm really bullish on American whiskey globally, the potential over the next decade, is when you look at our product, right? When you look at American whiskey, regardless of whether it's bourbon, rye, wheat, Tennessee, it's a real versatile product, to your point, right? It could be tailored and incorporated in mixology and cocktails to meet the local palate. For instance, again, Singapore, great bar scene, a very elevated hospitality scene there. They want premium products. There, a cocktail mixed goes between 25 and 30 Singapore, which is right about in line with American dollars. So what does that mean? The consumer is doing some pre-gaming, right? We're hearing about pre-gaming, although, not to date myself, but I graduated Florida State University in 2001. I feel like we were the pioneers of pre-gaming. Randy, I know you pre-gamed as well. But people are pre-gaming because of the cost of cocktails, right, when they go out. So you have a couple of drinks at home, responsibly get to your destination. You get to your destination. At that price point, you may only have 1 or 2 drinks. So what does that mean? You want something that you feel like you're getting a good return on your investment. You probably want a story about it. You probably want a higher proof because you're only going to have 2. And let's make something interesting. When you think about that, that's where American whiskey really thrives, right? That, I feel like it's tailor-made for that type of situation. In Singapore, I had a wasabi highball. And it was amazing. So local ingredients meet American whiskey, and you have an amazing cocktail on that cocktail menu. In India, I heard they're using young Indian ginger to make whiskey mules there. So wherever you go, they're taking, to your point, local ingredients, agave in Mexico, young Indian ginger in India, wasabi in Asia. I know they're using chili in South America to make some interesting cocktails. You put American whiskey in a mixologist's hands, and it's a versatile tool for them to just go crazy with. And I don't know if there's another spirit out there that you could do that with.
Yeah, it is amazing, and it's really fun to see, reading some of the magazines and whatnot, and they're talking about all the new cocktail creations that people are coming up with, and it's just fun to see, what's out there and to try different things. And I think people, like you said, they're looking for an experience. They want to go to a place that is kind of cool and order something that they don't have at home.
Right. Yes. Yeah. 100%.
I don't think people are waddling into bars anymore, like down at the local corner, and just ordering the same old thing that they used to order, 5,000 times in a row. I think they're looking for, experiences and something interesting, something like you said, something that people can talk about. It's kind of cool.
Right. Yeah. And even if you drink it neat or on the rocks, which I'm a huge fan of, even then the variety, the selection is amazing. And that's also why I'm really excited about what's going to happen over the next few years for the consumer. The amount of American whiskey aging right now is there's a lot. And you could either see that as a burden or you could see it as an asset. And I think a lot of our member companies, and when you talk to the master distillers and you talk to the people that are leading innovation, they're very excited about this. for the consumer, because the expressions, the age statements, the different finishes, the things that are come out, we think we've seen the heyday of American whiskey and bourbon. We haven't even scratched the surface yet. I think the next few years, I'm very, very excited for the consumer, because what they're going to get, they're going to get spoiled, and that's great.
Right. And you're touching on the kind of what Whiskey Advocate just came out with on their magazine. Now, you probably saw it was the ultra age trend, where some of these bottles are coming out with 18, 20 years, 25 years. And it's not always easy to do that in Kentucky, because it gets pretty hot in the summertime. Right.
Yes.
So it ages a little bit quicker than it would, in Scotland, for example, or something like that. But, what do you think of that trend? You think that trend will continue? And you said it's good for the consumer, which it seems to be.
Yeah, sure. Why not? So what's interesting, and so the American Whiskey Association really was started by American producers because they saw how effective the Scotch Whiskey Association has been for Scotch whiskey. And to my benefit, this organization did not exist prior to last year. And if it did, I probably wouldn't be here. But with the purpose of starting it to do what Scotch Whiskey Association and my colleague Mark Kent has done there is really, it's really impressive, right? Since, the late 30s, early 40s when they first started, and now they have a very impressive staff and a very impressive global budget, they've been able to go around the world and educate consumers on Scotch whiskey and really play up their strengths. What are their strengths? Their strengths are the age statement. And so when I go to another country and they say to me, Michael, how old is this bourbon? And I say, 6 years, 6 weeks, 6 days. They're like, really? I'm like, yeah, it says right here. I got to look it up. 6 years, 6 weeks, 6 days. They're like, wow, that's pretty impressive. But it's probably not as good as, say, a 15 or 18-year-old Scotch. And I say, oh, you don't know about American white oak. And so I go back to the cooperages and the American white oak story, which is amazing. First of all, American white oak, for those of you who know all about this, bear with me, but a really special tree only grown here in America, right? Then we take those, we make those barrels. Independence Day of Company has really educated me on this, but there's so many great cooperages out there. Putting these barrels together, not every stave is the same size. I mean, it's craftsmanship. Plus, they're lifting these barrels that are well over 100 pounds. I thought I was in really good shape until I tried to move some of these barrels, and I realized I am not. It's very humbling. But this American white oak barrel that has not been used before, right, is unused as a virgin barrel. And you put American whiskey in there, and it has not been aged. And then you obviously put it in these rickhouses. And the secret ingredient really is the American white oak barrel. It doesn't have to be in there as long as Scotch, because it's unused. Now, Scotch uses used American whiskey barrels. So I like to say the reason why Scotch is so good is because there's a little bit of American whiskey in there. But they have to keep it in there longer, all right, because they're using it over and over and over again. So what we're able to do in 6 years takes them a little bit longer. We have some education to do out there globally, right, with the consumer who just looks at the age statement and says, oh, 18 or 15 must be better than six. It's because they've not yet been informed about the American white oak barrel and the process and standards and heritage of American whiskey. We have some education to do there. But my point that I was getting to is that I think these more bolder and longer age statements that we're now seeing coming out of the American whiskey producers, it's only going to help us have that conversation. It's only going to help us compete. It's only going to help us celebrate and enjoy different expressions, different finishes. So to answer your question in a very, very long and roundabout way, I'm excited about it. I think it's a good thing. It helps us tell our story, helps us be more competitive. Why not?
And I'm fascinated by it. I mean, I'm reading things. I don't know how accurate everything I read is, but these days you got to wonder. But, read things like, okay, we're taking, this, 8, 9, 10-year-old, you know, aged barrel, and now we're going to stick it in a freezer for 9 more years. Because, you know, just like in Scotland, when a, you know, you only get about 4 months of time where the liquid is expanded into the barrel, and then the rest of the year it's contracted out of the wood. And it's not really picking up a lot of the flavor of the wood for those other 6 to 8 months. So it does take a lot longer. And, you know, so now if you can take an American bourbon and you say, all right, well, Kentucky's hot, but now if I stick it in a freezer for a few years, it's kind of about the same thing as Scotch. You get 18, 22, 25 years out of it. You can get some really old, you know, stuff. And, you know, people always, like you said, they assume that older is better. It's not necessarily, right? Would you agree with that?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, first of all, the other secret ingredient that we have here in the States, especially in Kentucky and Tennessee, you know, that entire Ohio, Indiana, is the climate, right? I was at University of Kentucky for their UK Distilling Institute conference that they had. And one day, when I got there, I think it was maybe in like the 60s. The next day, they had a snowstorm. And then, like, the next day, it was back up to the 60s. And then, you know, you think about those rickhouses. I can get, in the summertime, 120, 130. So the climate here is our other secret ingredient, right? That the contraction and expansion that takes place, it's chemistry. So that's our other secret ingredient besides the American white oak barrel. But the other secret ingredient is our distillers, right? We have some of the best distillers in the world. When you look at, you know, Mr. Russell, pre-prohibition trained master distiller. When you look at, you know, Samuels and all these legendary figures, the knowledge they have and the knowledge you're passing on and sharing. And by the way, even though these ladies and gentlemen are all fierce competitors, they are also friends and they share notes and they share, you know, knowledge. And so, I think that's our other competitive advantage is our community. And then, you know, what they're able to do in terms of like, let's age this in a cellar. Let's move this over here. Let's put this in cold storage. It's really incredible what they're doing and how they're finishing and how they're aging. And, it's really a good thing. It's a great thing. It's very exciting. So to your point, I'm here for it. I'm here to celebrate it. And when you taste this liquid, it's definitely different.
And it's so unique in that it's not as much of a blended product. I mean, some of them are really blended and they really go for that consistent, you know, every bottle is the same kind of thing, but a lot of them don't. And so you've got like a Four Roses with, you know, 12 different yeast mashes and all this stuff and going on and OESK and you're looking at the bottle and it'll make anybody's head spin. But, you know, a lot of them come out and they're very unique and every bottle could taste different, which is kind of cool as well. I mean, if you go into that that curve, it's pretty interesting.
Yeah. I mean, look what Maker's Mark. I'm in the Suntory office here in D.C., but look what Maker's Mark has done. You know, with their wheat whiskey and the cellar aged. Look what Wilderness Trail, you know, has done with the sweet mash bill. It's great.
It's fascinating, yeah. And so I read somewhere that you're working on a socioeconomic impact report.
Yes.
Is that accurate? Yeah. How's that coming along?
Yeah, so we're going to work with Oxford Economics, which is a leading group. They are going to put together the first ever grain-to-glass economic impact report for American whiskey. It's really going to show the entire value of the American whiskey supply chain. So from the farmers who grow the grain to the, you know, coopers, the distillers, then obviously the larger hospitality sector in the United States. But there's really not been an accurate study that takes into account all of this. And so really excited about getting this kicked off with Oxford Economics This will be an annual report for the American Whiskey Association. And I think you'll paint a really accurate picture, because we need to, in order to advocate for American whiskey, we really do need to understand the entire value of the supply chain, so that when we meet with, whether it's state elected officials or here in Washington, D.C., or we travel abroad and we're meeting with ambassadors and trade bodies and, you know, agricultural officers, they should know what American whiskey means to the U.S. economy, and make sure we have a total accurate picture of that.
And your office is primarily right in downtown Washington, D.C., on Pennsylvania Avenue, right?
Yeah, so I have the distinct honor of being able to what we used to call in the Marine Corps hot seat. So I work at a different offices with different member companies who have great offices here in Washington, D.C. And there's a few benefits to that. Number one, it changes up for me. I don't get bored of staring at the same office. But also, I get to spend time with each of the member companies' advocacy teams, and you know, when their commercial teams visit, that's really helpful. You know, different states, right? Different state representation, so different members of Congress who represent those districts. It's great. I'm very fortunate. I have to pinch myself sometimes about this job, the assets, the community, the network, but not just here in Washington, D.C. I mean, again, I was just over in Singapore, and to go to Singapore and see Brown-Forman's office there and Suntory Global's office there, and to meet with those folks and meet with the folks working for Sazerac on the ground, and then doing in-market visits. And I don't know, it's kind of a point of pride where you go to a bar or a restaurant or a hotel and you see the products that your, you know, member companies produce there on the back bar and on cocktail menus. And maybe it was a little sophomoric for me not to assume or not to know this, but there's teams that are just like they do here in the U.S. that are going there and selling and educating, just really amazing. And to go back to how this all started, this global network of trade. I mean, you know, the global network of trade for the U.S. at least, you can go back to Ben Franklin, and you could see what he and Thomas Jefferson established with wine trade. But then when George Washington began distilling and American distillers came here, it's a beautiful immigration story about how distillers came here and began distilling. Whiskey rebellion happened, so they don't stop work with rye, but some continue working with rye in Pennsylvania, but others go out west and discover corn and start making bourbon, right? Then we start to export that product. And sort of interesting, because there's some similarities here, and I learned this when I went over to Wild Turkey, was when bourbon was really down in a bad place in the 80s, right? They couldn't give this stuff away. They looked to Japan as a key export market, and they began exporting American whiskey to Japan. And some will say that the Japanese market really helped the bourbon suppliers and the American whiskey market make their way out of what was a really bad and tough time for American whiskey. So Japan, as an export market, really did the bourbon producers in Kentucky a huge solid, right, by becoming a great market for them to have access to. And conversely, we created this amazing whiskey that the Japanese just fell in love with. And then, you know, the marriage between Suntory and Beam is, you know, in the storybooks, and it's amazing. And the collaboration and the sharing of distilling knowledge is awesome. I share that story because I feel like India and parts of Asia will become those markets that help us get out of what is a state of normalization and into a phase of global growth that is historic. And so if I could predict anything on your podcast today, when they find this, online or whatever platform 10 years from now and look back at this, I will predict that American whiskey will be in a global growth phase that will be not only historic, but something that will continue to fuel the industry here in the U.S. And I'll say here, I think we're going to take market share from other world's whiskeys, because American whiskey, we are on a mission. It will become the world's whiskey.
Yeah, to your point, I mean, one of my favorite remembrances or stories from one of our early podcasts we did was with Harlan Wheatley at Buffalo Trace. And, you know, he talked about the 80s when he would go to bars and it'd be like, you know, talk to the bartenders who are like, oh, we don't need any of that stuff. Right. We have a bottle back there. That's all. Yeah. That's all we need. We have no demand for this stuff. But you couldn't give it away.
Yeah.
And now, you know, Buffalo Trace produces some of the most sought after, you know, products in the marketplace. It's pretty cool how things have changed. Going to get better.
They're killing it over there. What a great team, great leadership over there. Amazing distiller, amazing distilleries to visit. I mean, just a world-class organization. But when you look at all the founding members of AWA, they are literally first-class, world-class organizations who are leading. And I take my, you know, stewardship of their brands in this category and even consumers very seriously. And you know, we all play a role in this. Like when we travel abroad, we're on vacation, have a conversation with the mixologist, have a conversation with your server, or when you're at your hotel, you know, ask about American whiskey, share stories. That's what this product's about. It brings people together. It's about storytelling. You can educate them just as much as you educate, you know, they educate you. Whenever I go to Italy with the family, or I'm always teaching a bartender how to make it old fashioned because I ask for it. They usually, depending on where you go, they'll sometimes just give you soda water with like bourbon and an orange slice. And I'm like, okay, you mind if I get back there and like we could talk about this? So we're all advocates. We're all ambassadors. We have something very proud that we can share. And the other beautiful thing about this is that American whiskey is above all the politics of the day. So then no matter where you go, someone will ask you where you're from, say America. There may be some, you know, awkward conversations for the first 1 or 2 minutes, but if you bring it back to American whiskey, I guarantee you, you'll find common ground and it'll be a great interaction.
And you'll make new friends, that's for sure.
And you'll make new friends. Yes, we'll make new friends. And by the way, some of our best friends are people who bring us over a bottle of American whiskey. Like, you can't lie. You know who your good friends are. They bring you over something special. You're like, all right, this person, they just went up in my ranking of friends. So
that's right. That's right. Got to invite them back.
That's right.
Absolutely. So, so we spend a good amount of our time, talking to, distillers and, you know, master distillers, and Connor O'Driscoll's going to be on one of our upcoming podcasts and from Heaven Hill. And one of my favorite people is an artisanal distiller, Jody Filiatra, who's also with Heaven Hill. And he works out there at the Bourbon Experience. And just, you know, like you said, great people, really smart people, so many chemical engineers, so many women getting into this business, becoming master distillers now. Very, very cool. It's a really interesting business, and I enjoy it tremendously. But if you had any advice for us, you know, what would you say? What's the best way for Whiskey Shenanigans podcast to partner with some of these folks?
So I think, first of all, you're giving everyone a platform, right? That's the first thing. And you're very easy to have a conversation with. So I think if you use your platform as you have and getting people to, you know, share their stories, share the things that they're working on, their efforts, right? Making sure that people understand that, ask questions about why is this important? You know, why are you doing this? I think the more people you have from the American whiskey ecosystem, from, again, the distillers to, you know, a public policy guy, I think your listeners and you as well, you'll piece together everything we're working on. It's really impressive, right? Even though this is a massive industry and we have a lot of product and we have a lot of different people and we're fierce competitors, globally, what we are all focused on, making American whiskey the world's whiskey. And I don't know about you, but when you meet these folks and you've interviewed a lot of them, I don't think there's anything that's going to stop us, right? We're all very determined. We're all very resourceful. We're all very committed. And by the way, we have a world-class product. And a lot of the world hasn't even met it yet, right? They've not gotten liquid to lips yet. But when they do, think about that emotional reaction you have when you taste something for the first time. Or maybe it's even something for the fifth, sixth, seventh time, but it's just so special. Think about that emotional reaction, and now think about the people who haven't had that yet. That's really exciting. And then also think about, again, the mixologists. I mean, the mixologists, those are our evangelists. We need to do more mixology exchanges. I would encourage you to have more mixologists on, because these are the folks that are educating our consumers, that are engaging with our consumers, who say to someone who bellies up at the bar, I know you just ordered this, you know, ready for this, I'll use an example. I know you've ordered an espresso martini with vodka, but have you tried an espresso martini with rye whiskey? Have you tried a Bloody Mary with bourbon? When I was over in Singapore, there is so many great clubs, so many great bars, and the espresso martini is something that everyone orders there, right? Because they want a little pick-me-up. I asked everywhere I go, I challenge them, I said, have you ever made this with rye whiskey? Now, it has to be the right rye whiskey, but there's some out there that make an incredible espresso martini. And when you do that, the mixologist's eyes open up, right? And what I love about them is they'll mix it and they'll take that straw and they'll take a little sample in the straw and they'll taste it. And then their eyes light up and they're like, I never thought about this. But guess what? Now they're going to offer that up to the next few people who come through that bar, who come through that restaurant, who come through their hotel. And then when they have it at the bar or the hotel, right, on premise is where discovery happens, they then go home and they tell a friend and they do it in their home bar.
So that's great. Well, I don't want to take up any more of your time. I really, really appreciate you coming on and sharing all this information with us. Well, thank you so much again, Michael. We really appreciate having you on, and we will talk to you again. And if you're at a Bourbon Fest in September, I'll be there, and you know, we'll probably run into each other. Have a good day, Michael.
Welcome, Whiskey Shenanigans fans, to the Whiskey Shenanigans portion of this episode. Thought we'd take on another topic today: why whiskey is central in American culture. So doing some research on this, it seems that particularly bourbon, but whiskey in general, occupies a pretty distinct place in American cultural history, architecture, not merely as a spirit, a distilled spirit, but also as more of a social instrument. It's a medium through which stories are told, milestones are marked, and continuity across generations is quietly reinforced. Unlike beverages that are consumed casually, whiskey tends to appear when something meaningful is happening or about to be said. At a structural level, this begins with bourbon's legal and geographical identity. By definition, bourbon is uniquely American, codified by law and historically rooted in states like Kentucky and Tennessee. That origin story matters. From frontier distillation practices to post-Civil War industrialization, whiskey has evolved alongside the country itself. It became associated with self-reliance, craftsmanship, and a certain rugged individualism, themes that still resonate with Americans today. To fully understand whiskey's place in American culture, you have to widen the lens and include the mythology of the American West, because this is where whiskey stopped being just a product and became a symbol of something more. As settlers pushed west in the 19th century, whiskey traveled with them, not just as a luxury, but as a necessity. On the frontier, infrastructure was thin, life was volatile, trust was scarce. Whiskey filled a lot of different roles simultaneously. It was currently an antiseptic, a moral booster, social glue, a bottle that settled nerves after a cattle drive, maybe, to close a deal, or to establish a fragile sense of order in an otherwise somewhat chaotic condition. The saloon became an operational hub of the frontier town. It wasn't just a bar, it was the closest thing they had to a civic center. Deals were negotiated there, disputes were aired, alliances were formed, and almost invariably, these interactions were mediated by whiskey. The act of pouring and sharing a drink created a temporary contract, a pause in hostilities, a willingness to engage. In an environment where formal institutions were weak, or maybe even non-existent, whiskey helped to create informal ones. This is where the cowboy enters the cultural equation. The cowboy archetype, independent, restrained, guided by a personal code, aligns closely with how Americans still perceive whiskey today. There's an economy to both. Cowboys didn't indulge in excess. They operated with discipline. When whiskey appeared in the context, it's not about intoxication. It's about punctuation. A long day comes to an end. The job well done, completed. A moment is being recognized. American film and television have reinforced this association for many decades. One great example is Unforgiven. In Unforgiven, whiskey is used deliberately as a narrative device. Clint Eastwood's character, William Money, is a reformed outlaw whose return to violence is marked by his return to drinking. The bottle signals a shift, not just in behavior, but in identity. Who is William Money? Whiskey becomes a boundary line between restraint and reckoning. But whiskey's deeper cultural role emerges from rituals that have unfolded over a lot of time. Pouring whiskey tends to slow things down. It demands your presence. Unlike just drinking a beer or a glass of wine, which can be consumed continuously, whiskey is typically poured in measured quantities, neat on the rocks or in a cocktail. That pacing creates space for conversation. It's no coincidence that some of the most important interpersonal exchanges in American life have happened over a glass of bourbon. Reconciliations, confessions, negotiations, and maybe most importantly, reflections. Consider how often whiskey appears in our storytelling, both fictional and real, as a catalyst for truth-telling. In Mad Men, Don Draper's constant companion is a glass of rye or bourbon. It's not just aesthetic. It signals moments of introspection, moral ambiguity, and identity conflict. The drink becomes shorthand for complexity, an emotional solvent that loosens guarded narratives. Similarly, in The Godfather, whiskey appears in scenes of negotiation, power consolidation, and where that's said and unsaid, and where what is said and what is unsaid carries literally life and death consequences. Whiskey also marks transition points, promotions, retirements, weddings, funerals. These aren't really beer occasions. They're whiskey occasions. The act of raising a glass of bourbon carries a symbolic weight, acknowledgement of time, effort, and shared experience. In this sense, whiskey functions almost liturgically, formalizing what is previously informal. American cinema reinforces this association in Crazy Stupid Love. Ryan Gosling's character schools Steve Carell over how to carefully prepare an old-fashioned, a bourbon-based cocktail that itself represents tradition and reinvention. The drink becomes a vehicle for transformation, signaling a shift in identity and confidence. Then in Yellowstone, a very recent example, bourbon is omnipresent, used to underscore legacy, land, familial continuity. The characters don't just drink. It's how they process their inheritance, the conflict that they're in, and the loyalties that they preserve. In Tombstone, saloon scenes are dense with meaning. When characters gather over whiskey, they're not merely socializing. They're establishing hierarchies, testing loyalties, and signaling their intent. A glass set down too hard, a refill ordered or refused. These are cues of some high-stake social languages. Even outside the overt Westerns, the cowboy whiskey linkage persists. In Yellowstone, that lineage is modernized. The Dutton family operates in a contemporary setting, but their behaviors echo frontier logic, land, legacy, and loyalty above all. Bourbon is ever present, functioning as a ritual connector between the past and the present. When the characters drink, they're participating in a continuum that stretches back to the original West. What makes this association durable is that it encodes values that Americans still hold true today. self-reliance, accountability, and a certain cowboy stoicism. Whiskey, like the cowboy, is unadorned. It doesn't require explanation or embellishment. You pour it, you sit with it, and if the moment calls for it, you speak plainly. But whiskey bridges the American continental divide, not the geological continental divide, but the generational continental divide. So beyond this parallelism between the growth of America and the growth of whiskey, what's notable is how whiskey does bridge this generational divide. A father and son, they might not have a whole lot in common in terms of their music they listen to or the politics or the technology they use, but they can share a pour of bourbon and still find common ground. The sensory profile, the oak, the vanilla, the caramel, the spice, it's literally tied to time itself, extracted from years in a barrel. When someone opens a bottle that they've saved for decades, they're not just consuming whiskey. They're consuming stored time. That makes it uniquely suited for intergenerational storytelling. There's also an economic and social accessibility dimension to this. While there are ultra-premium bottles out there, for sure, now more than ever, bourbon broadly remains attainable. A $30 to $80 bottle can be exceptional, which democratizes participation in all of our rituals. You don't need luxury to engage in these meaningful moments. You need just intention. That accessibility reinforces whiskey's role as a unifying agent rather than an exclusionary agent. Even in marketing, whiskey is rarely positioned as just party fuel. Instead, it's framed around authenticity, heritage, and connection. Brands like Buffalo Trace or Maker's Mark emphasize lineage and craftsmanship, subtly aligning the product with personal legacy. The message is implicit. This is what you bring out when it matters. In practice, the most enduring whiskey moments, they're not that dramatic. They're quiet. Two people on the porch, a small group after dinner, a solitary drink that marks the end of a chapter. These are not scenes of excess. They're scenes of reflection. And that's precisely why whiskey endures as a cultural constant in America. It creates a controlled environment for openness, structured enough to feel intentional, but relaxed enough to be honest. In that sense, whiskey, it doesn't just accompany American life. It helps articulate American life. It provides a vocabulary for moments that are otherwise can be difficult to put into words, to frame. Things like pride, regret, transition, and reconciliation. And across generation, it remains one of the few rituals that still reliably brings people to the same table. That's why, even today, when Americans reach for whiskey, they mark a moment they're implicitly drawing from the Western lineage. Whether they realize it or not, they're invoking a tradition where sharing a drink meant something. Something specific. We're here. We've done the work. And now we're going to sit down together and say what needs to be said. In that sense, whiskey doesn't just connect generations. It connects eras. From frontier saloons to modern living rooms, the function remains consistent. It creates a controlled space for honesty. A brief suspension of all the noise around us, and a setting where stories, earned stories, can be told, understood, and added to our legacy. That's it for today, Whiskey Shenanigans. Thanks for joining us.
How did I get to here was, you know, in high school, like, I was very good at math and I was very good at science, which doesn't sound like a problem, but I just desperately wanted to be good at art and music. Like all of my cool friends were good at art and music and I wanted to be as cool as them, but I was just a math nerd and like no matter what I did, I couldn't help it. And so this for me is as close as I can come being good mostly at math to making art. And I think that's what really brought me and drove me to whiskey. Unfortunately, no one mentions that as a potential career path when you're like in high school and in college, you know, it's not brought up. So I went to school to study chemical engineering. because that's what I was good at. You know, chemistry and math.